It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover. And starting out with the big one, the lazy bee, apparently flying the coop.
On the day when the line between the living and dead is at its thinnest.
Yes. Well, they did put a couple of nails in their own coffin this week when they announced finally that they were moving the new 787 plant. They were going to build it in Charleston, South Carolina. This was not a surprise to me. It was a major surprise for local media people and some local politicians who expressed shock and dismay. I found that kind of amusing because to see these local media people say, oh, in the kind of hushed tone of voice, Boeing is no longer a local company.
I'm really astonished that it's going to South Carolina, because frankly, if Boeing could get away with it, they would send it to Cameroon.
Yeah.
The whole idea behind this is the cheapest possible labor, and the average wage for a line worker in Puget Sound area for a Boeing worker is $28 an hour. In South Carolina, it's $14
an
hour.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, you're just not going to make up that difference, even though the state of Washington has thrown $3.2 billion, that's B as in billion dollars, in tax incentives over the last 20 years to Boeing. Of course it's not going to be enough, because, you know, you hear all this caterwauling about what a fine corporate citizen Boeing is to this region and how it pumps so much money into the local economy, but that is exactly the problem. From Boeing's standpoint, it doesn't want to pump money into the local economy, and people here just don't get that.
Yeah. So I thought it was kind of interesting to see all that, you know, what did we do wrong, and pressure put on the local union by local politicians and media to give more concessions to Boeing, when in fact they were entirely missing out on the dynamic here, which is that Boeing was using its move to South Carolina to try to pressure the local union to give it concessions. It wasn't the reverse, that if the union, you know, it wasn't the reverse that the union had any power to say, if we give some concessions, Boeing will stay. I think the union adequately recognized the dynamic, and local media and politicians didn't.
Yeah, and it was very, very reminiscent, actually, of the Seattle Sonics situation, where you had a corporate entity that was hell-bent on pursuing one strategy. In the Sonics case, they were owned by people in Oklahoma who wanted the franchise in Oklahoma,
and they would have been
happy to extract an outrageous deal out of the local people in this area. That wasn't going to happen, but if it had, you know, they wouldn't have minded, but they still would have moved.
Wouldn't have mind staying for a year or two with
an outrageous deal,
but yeah.
They still would have moved.
Mm-hmm. In the end.
Well, then let's move on and talk about one of our other local favorite companies, which would be Microsoft.
Yeah, an interesting report item in Slashdot from our friend Jeff Reifman, that while Microsoft bases its software licensing business in Nevada, and there's a reason for that, because licensing income or revenue is taxed in Washington State, but it's not in the state of Nevada. So Microsoft, for tax purposes, bases it there. But funny thing, when it has to pursue a lawsuit against somebody for an infringement of that license, as it did in a current case called Microsoft Licensing versus TSR Silicon, it uses Washington state law. Presumably, it operates in Nevada, so it therefore should either be a case for a Nevada court or a New York court, which is where TSR Silicon is based. The only thing Washington has to do with it is that courts in Washington state, according to Microsoft, are more likely bought and sold, more sympathetic. If Microsoft licensing does have standing in Washington state court, that also suggests that Microsoft ought to be paying Washington state taxes on it. That would be more than $1 billion in taxes, interest, and penalties.
Yeah, that would go a long way towards plugging some holes in the state budget, I think.
Yeah, and it would also make up for all that money we shovel good after bad to Boeing.
All right. Interesting. Moving on, Norm Dix getting investigation?
Yeah, actually several members of the the Defense Subcommittee, the Appropriations Committee. And if you remember, when the Republicans were running Congress, that was the committee or one of the committees where Republicans like Duke Cunningham got in a lot of trouble. Dix is being investigated for ethics violations by the Ethics Committee for steering earmarks to clients of a major contributor of his, a lobby shop, now defunct lobby shop called PMA. And this what just really underscores how thoroughly corrupt in both parties the military appropriations process is in this country, and what a money hole it is. And Norm Dix, of course, with all the various military facilities in his district in Kitsap County, is a big part of what he's all about is military policy and advocating for his military constituents, and apparently he's making sure that they bring home the bacon as well.
Yeah, and the only reason we know about this investigation is because an intern had posted confidential ethics committee investigations material on a computer that the public had access to, so a bunch of media people were able to access it, reporters were able to access it and report on it. And I think really in terms of ethics committee investigations, that stuff ought to be much more public than it is, that this is a good thing, not a bad thing, that we know which members are under investigations for ethics complaints and what those are.
Moving on, Referendum 71.
Yeah, we've mentioned in past weeks that the folks opposing Referendum 71, that's the measure that's on the ballot that would codify the legislators' passage this past spring of a law giving domestic partnership rights to both gay and straight unmarried couples. That the folks opposing that, primarily Christian conservatives, can't take big donations. When they made their court victory over being able to keep their petition signature signers for qualifying for the ballot secret, they went into federal court and tried also to see if they could get last minute huge donations into their campaign in violation of campaign law, and federal court slapped them down this week and said nope, can't do that.
Yeah, they had some success challenging the privacy law for campaign people who had signed petitions. Now they're trying to challenge the law, the Washington state law that forbids donations of over $5,000 in the last 3 weeks of a campaign before an election. And that's interesting precedent. And the judge, the U.S. District Court judge, said no, you know, I don't find that a valid challenge.
Yeah, and they did have such donations lined up. And as we mentioned last week, that's very much an indication that there are a few large donors funding that campaign instead of many small donors as are funding the Yes on 71 campaign.
All right. And then finally, locally, Vancouver, the one north of us as opposed to the one south.
The Olympics are in Vancouver, but the torch was in Victoria yesterday. They were kicking
which
off
the... Which is the capital city of B.C.
Yes, it is, and it's also, you know, got a harbor and big, yeah, old British kind of looking buildings.
All
and,
the big yeah. government buildings
yeah.
are there.
Yeah, and so they were kicking off their cross-Canada run of the Olympic torch in preparation for the February Olympics in Vancouver, of which we're going to hear a lot more. And funny thing, but several hundred protesters in Victoria yesterday jamming the streets of downtown Victoria and essentially forcing the Olympic torch run, all the people carrying the torch to be bundled into a minivan and trundled off to the waterfront to avoid all the protesters. They basically had to call off the ceremonial run. All the protesters, of course, complaining that, and including a number of Aborigine groups complaining that Vancouver and the province of British Columbia is spending huge amounts of money on the Olympics and virtually no money instead on all the pressing social needs that, like us, they have up to the north as well. We're going to be hearing a lot more, I think, because there's a lot of protests scheduled around the Olympics as they unfold in Vancouver and Whistler coming up in February.
All right. Moving on to national and this week's developments with healthcare.
Yeah, the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, introduced the public option back into the bill that's making its way through the Senate. But he added it in terms of an opt-out plan so that states now have the ability to opt out of the public option, which I think is guaranteed
similar to the way Medicaid is now set up, where you know, states that want to have Medicaid systems, states that don't, all of them now have Medicaid. Mm-hmm. That took about 15 years before that happened, but a number of them, especially ones in the South and red states, very much underfund it.
Yeah, and that's what would happen here as well. What it would do is it would set up a situation where people who are not covered by insurance will be worse off if this plan passes, because it's going to include a mandate for them to buy coverage or else pay a penalty. And then if their state is opting out of a public option and therefore opting out of a cheap option for them, they would end up having to buy basically catastrophic coverage for a relatively small fee, which would still be a burdensome fee for the poor.
It'd still be a lot,
and it wouldn't cover anything for them.
And even if they had catastrophic illness, you know, in a lot of cases, the insurance companies won't cover that anymore either.
Right. So it's really really going to put those people in a worse position than they're in now, I think.
Yeah, and this was also just strategically speaking, potentially a huge procedural error on the part of Reid, in that he had the option to wait and try and reintroduce a public option after the reconciliation process between the House and the Senate. He has the option still to go to a budget reconciliation process, which would require only 50 votes rather than the 60 needed for cloture of debate in the Senate. But instead, he was requiring on every member of his caucus, and already several members of the Democratic caucus have said no public option, no way, including Joe Lieberman, who had all of his Democratic committee privileges restored even after he endorsed McCain and voted for, or campaigned rather, for Republicans, and did everything possible in Bush time to undermine the Democratic opposition to Bush's foreign policy initiatives, if you want to call them that. But war crimes might be a better
term. Yeah.
Term, anyway. But Lieberman did all this, and he cut a deal with the Democratic leadership, getting his, even though he ran as an independent also in his last election, and quit the Democratic Party, he caucuses with the Democratic caucus in return for pledging not to vote for a filibuster. In other words, he's pledging to do right now exactly what he said he wouldn't do when he got all of his Democratic committee assignments. So those assignments ought to be yanked. But unfortunately, it looks so far like the Democratic leadership doesn't have the guts to actually
do that. Yep.
All right. Anything else on healthcare? Or we can move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, the big news this week was GMAC, the company that finances auto loans for people who buy cars from GM and Chrysler, is coming back to the public trough for its third taxpayer bailout. The only company that's received bailout funds so far was coming back a third time. And, of course, it looks like they're going to be declared too big to fail, and they're going to get the money that they want. They want $5 to $6 billion, and they've already received about $12.5 billion from taxpayers. Of course, the main problem for GMAC comes not from its auto loan unit, which is doing quite well, particularly after the Cash for Clunkers program gave it a boost, but the main problem comes from its home mortgage unit that, yes, indeed, GMAC, which makes auto loans, got into the home mortgage business during the real estate bubble, and it made some very risky loans, and that's now what's dragging it under. The U.S. government, after having given it $12.5 billion, owns about a 35% ownership share for that $12.5 billion. And if it gives another $5 to $6 billion, it's probably going to have a majority ownership, in which case it ought to do what the British government did with a couple of its major banks. It ought to say, okay,
exercise ownership.
Yes, we are the majority owner, therefore we're going to kick out upper management. We're going to split the company into two pieces. We're going to create a profitable company, which is the auto loan unit, which is what GMAC was originally set up to do. That's going to be the surviving company. And then we're going to create a second company, which is the unhealthy mortgage loan company, and that one we're going to shut down, and we're going to make the shareholders take the hit, and we're going to make the creditors who loaned money to that unit take the hit as well. That's what they should do. That's what the British government did with two of its major banks.
Actually, three.
Yeah, three. And what they're doing with those banks that they nationalized, they're going to cut them up, separate them into profitable units that they can resell and recoup some of their investment. And they're going to shut down and make the shareholders take the hit on
so
the
what's
ones
the president of Goldman Sachs, I mean, the United States, going to do?
Oh, not going to do that. The Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, of course, he's a former Goldman Sachs employee. Goldman Sachs being one of the 10 largest banks in the U.S., primarily an investment bank, but is now considered a bank holding company, so it qualifies for U.S. taxpayer money. Tim Geithner isn't going to do that. He's looking at deals to try to rescue GMAC that will not give the U.S. government a majority ownership stake that will allow it to nationalize and exert any control over GMAC's upper management or do any of those things, which I think is execrable. I think Geithner ought to be kicked out just for that reason. But instead, GMAC is going to get rescued.
Yeah, no investor would put that kind of money into a private business without demanding
without
a majority
control.
Share.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's being done with taxpayer dollars makes it that much worse.
Yeah, and this week also the other big piece of news on the economic front is Geithner and Barney Frank, head of the Financial Services Committee, they introduced new legislation that's supposed to address that too big to fail problem that that a lot of financial companies have gotten into. And what they want to do is they want to shift the cost of bailouts of these big financial companies onto the shoulders of other big financial companies with this legislation. It would create a special fund from assessments on financial companies with more than $10 billion in assets. That special fund would then bail out companies that go under. But the assessments would only be made after the collapse of a large financial institution. And any money that's not used in the rescue would then be paid back to the big companies. In other words, it's sort of an emergency thing that would happen after a big company would be at risk of failure. It would also create an oversight panel chaired by, guess who, Geithner himself, the Treasury Secretary, to oversee these large companies. And then the government would have the okay from the legislative branch to take over failing companies and nationalize them.
Though, two words, Fox Hen House.
Yeah, well, though I don't see why they can't do that now without, but, you know, because the FDIC does that with banks, I don't see why they can't do that now. But FDIC chair, interestingly enough, FDIC chair Sheila Bair criticized Geithner's plan. She said, for one thing, the Oversight Council shouldn't be run by the Treasury Secretary, but by an independent chairperson. And she's completely correct in that. And two, she said that council should have more authority to write minimum rules of conduct for large financial companies, which they wouldn't have under the current legislation that's proposed. And she said, finally, that they should levy the assessment before companies fail. They should make big financial firms pay the assessment into the special fund before a company fails, and that should serve as a deterrent and a disincentive for companies to reach that size in order to avoid paying the assessment. And I think she's right about that. Geithner, of course, said, oh, no, that would be encouraging risky behavior by providing an insurance fund. But excuse me, that's what the FDIC is, really. It's an insurance fund that provides some coverage for people whose deposits are in banks that have failed.
So I have two questions. One, uh-huh. and they're hopefully quick questions. One, yeah. When is the Obama administration actually going to enact reforms and put an end to this nonsense?
Well, the reforms they can't enact reforms. Congress has to enact reforms.
Well, they haven't proposed any.
And, well, they have proposed reforms, but the reforms are minor, and this is another part of their kind of minor tinkering with the system. In other words, moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic.
And how long is Sheila Bair going to have a job?
Well, Timothy Geithner tried to get Sheila Bair dismissed when he became Treasury Secretary, and she resisted that, and Obama resisted dismissing her. So clearly, this is yet another salvo in the war between Sheila Bair and Timothy Geithner, and in the end, we'll see who wins out on this. You can tell whose side I'm on.
All right. Moving on, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, which has made a name for itself in recent years by funding denial of climate change. It's the arm of big business, and particularly big oil and coal firing plants in the energy sector in this country. They have sued the Yes Men after the Yes Men staged a fake press conference at the National Press Club last week to announce that the chamber was changing its stance on climate change and supporting capping greenhouse gas emissions. Several news outlets, including Reuters, CNBC, and Fox Business Channel, reported the policy change as fact before issuing corrections. The chamber is suing them for the Yes Men for misappropriating its logo and violating a host of related copyrights. The Yes Men, by the way, are pretty much broke, and they are coming here to Seattle for a fundraiser at the end of the month on the anniversary, 10th anniversary of the WTO demonstrations for the premiere of their new movie. So go check that out when they hit town.
All right. That then takes us on to international, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, on Sunday there were two synchronized suicide bombings in downtown Baghdad of the Justice Ministry and the Provincial Council complex that left hundreds dead and wounded. The biggest bombing, actually, since August 19th, when a bombing killed about 100 people in a similar area of the city. Now, if we look at the list of government buildings in Baghdad that have been bombed and destroyed by insurgent attacks, that it includes the Foreign Ministry, the Finance Ministry, the Justice Ministry, the Municipalities and Public Works Ministry, and the Baghdad Provincial Headquarters. Now, they're all located near the Green Zone, and bombers have had to drive their vehicles through multiple police checkpoints in order to get there. As a consequence, the federal government has put under arrest about 61 police officers, Baghdad police officers, who were responsible for manning checkpoints on Sunday in the city. They're trying to discover which one of them was the corrupt jerks who allowed these guys to drive through police checkpoints
after paying
a bribe. So they just
arrested everybody.
Yeah, so they just arrested everybody to try to find out who actually was the one who accepted bribes that allowed these guys to drive through police checkpoints. It's an indication, first of all, that the civil war is continuing in Iraq, in spite of the media coverage here, and also an indication, too, that the Iraqi government has some pretty serious corruption problems. If these guys could drive massive truck bombs through multiple police checkpoints to get to the heart of Baghdad for a second time in the last two to three months.
All right. That takes us on then to Afghanistan.
Yeah, a couple of big news things on Afghanistan. Matthew Ho, a former Marine Corps captain and who was the senior U.S. civilian managing Zabul province, for folks who don't know where Zabul province is in Afghanistan, it's just north of Kandahar and just south of Paktika province, right on the border with Pakistan. So it's a strategically important province in the war in Afghanistan. In September, he became the first U.S. official employed by the State Department to resign in protest over the war in Afghanistan. His resignation was so serious that both Afghan U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, and Richard Holbrook, who is the senior member within the State Department that manages Afghanistan, Pakistan, he's the head of the AFPAC office, tried to persuade Ho to stay in his position. But I just want to read a quote from him. He said, quote, "I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy, but my resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end." In other words, he's saying essentially we're sending Americans over there to die in what is a civil war in Afghanistan, and that we really don't have a good reason to be there. And he supports a reduction in U.S. troops, which I find interesting given that the Obama administration is clearly now leaning towards adding more troops. It's just a question of how many and where. The current Obama strategy is now looking at a combination of the McChrystal idea, pouring more troops into the country, with the Biden strategy, which is use those troops to protect population centers and rely on unmanned aerial drones to take care of the rural portions of the country. In other words,
and local thugs. Don't forget the local thugs.
Oh yeah, no, that's the other big story I want to talk about. Ahmed Wali Karzai, the president's brother, Hamid Karzai's brother, it turns out, is a CIA asset. He also runs our third column in Afghanistan, a paramilitary force called the Kandahar Strike Force.
And also a man widely believed to be neck deep in the heroin trade.
Right, right. One of the many paramilitary death squads that we support in eastern Afghanistan in the fight against the Taliban. Evidently, the Kandahar Strike Force runs raids against suspected insurgents, and that sometimes includes running raids against police jails and police headquarters in parts of eastern Afghanistan when they want to break out their own criminal members who have been arrested by the local police. So, interestingly enough, we had a senior civilian person in eastern Afghanistan running the war, who resigned because he believes that local groups are fighting the U.S. military to try to get our troops out of their villages and out of their valleys, not so much because they support the corrupt national government in Kabul, or so much that they don't particularly support the Taliban. They just want to see us out, and that's why he's resigning. And we had news that the president's brother is a CIA asset,
as was the president himself before he became president.
Yeah,
Karzai, that is.
And of course the same guys who leaked this information also pretty much said, yeah, we know that Karzai's brother is a drug runner. We just don't have the proof to show you, and we don't particularly want to show that proof to the American public. Isn't that what you call one degree of separation? The CIA and drug running. Where have we heard that story before?
All right.
For the last 40 years.
Yes.
Other news on Afghanistan?
We had Abdullah, who is the opponent to Karzai in next Saturday's runoff presidential election, threatening to pull out and boycott the election due to the complete lack of reforms that have taken place and the potential for ballot stuffing and similar kinds of mischief in next Saturday's election that happened in the original election in August. So let's keep an eye on that in the next week.
All right. And then Copenhagen.
Yeah, the Copenhagen summit that's coming up in about a month, that will be a major UN gathering on climate change legislation, and the Obama administration being supportive this past week of the gutting of a proposal on a pact which was meant to protect rainforests, but the idea behind the original agreement was that countries that cut down rainforests and convert them to plantations of trees such as oil palms would still be able to classify the results as forest and could receive millions of dollars meant for preserving them. An earlier version of the text had ruled out such a conversion, but that safeguard has been deleted with the blessing of the Obama administration.
Yeah, I find that interesting that they're encouraging that, but studies have found that if you encourage farmers to engage in organic farming practices, that could sequester far more carbon than these so-called plantation forests could ever do.
All right. And very briefly, Honduras.
Yeah, that power sharing agreement has taken place between ousted President Zelaya and the coup leaders in Honduras, but it comes less than a month before the November 29th election, at which Zelaya is terminated out of existence, and the coup leaders are allied with the National Party candidate that is leading in the polls for that. So while this was spun in the United States as a great triumph for American diplomacy and democracy, in fact, it's not a triumph for democracy, because the coup leaders achieved exactly what they wanted to achieve, which is they kept Zelaya out of power for the most of the remainder of his term, and he will have almost no power in the remaining month.
All right. Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State is found where you find free publications, bookstores, libraries, King County libraries system, you know, et cetera. And this is actually this past issue was the endorsement issue, although it's still on the front of our website. And check that out. Don't forget to vote November 3rd, particularly yes on referendum 91, no on 1030.
Yes on 71. Referendum 71.
71, I'm sorry. no on 1033, yes on Dow Constantine, Alakaya, and Bloom and O'Brien, and yes on the housing levy. So November 3rd is for that, and then you can also find all of those election endorsements at www.eatthestate.org. And don't forget also, we have coming up a roast of me on my 50th birthday coming up on November 13th. That'll be a benefit for Eat the State at 7:30 at University Baptist Church. We'll talk about that more next week. And then also coming up the end of next month is the, as mentioned before, the 10th anniversary of WTO, and we're going to be doing an anniversary issue for that. So for people who have stories about what they went through in 1999 or what they're doing now about free trade and climate change issues, email us and tell us your story at editorial@eatthestate.org.